Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Greenfield-Feig. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Marty Helena, Executive Director of the Vancouver Aquarium Marine Mammal Rescue Society and Vancouver Aquarium Staff Veterinarian. On this episode, we're going to highlight some of the great rescue and rehabilitative work Marty and his team are doing, including sea lion disentanglements, as well as a fascinating field project involving killer whales. So without further ado, hi, Marty. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Of course. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to talk with you about all of the work that you do up in Vancouver, both at the aquarium and with the Marine Mammal Rescue Facility. So before we go into all of that, can you share with our listeners a story about when you realized that you'd made it as an aquatic veterinarian?
Oh my, I don't think I've made it as an aquatic animal veterinarian. I mean, every day is a new challenge, right? I suppose it's cool when folks that you really, really respect just call you by your first name and, you know, call you and have a drink with you and are friends with you, right? So folks like Bill Van Bont or Eric Jensen, and of course, all my mentors, and Larry Dunn and Francis Gullin. So, you know, when you can sit and get invited to have a drink at the bar, you know, and they just chit chat with you about your life, I went, oh, wow, this is so cool to be part of this group. It's really neat.
And it's wonderful. I feel like the aquatic community is also really good about introducing students to that as well. And at conferences and going out to dinner, or going to the bar or something. And you still haven't made it yet as a student, but being welcomed into that community and feeling comfortable around everyone, I think is a really unique aspect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a small community, but a very lovely community. It's been awesome to be part of the community. A lot of those folks that I see at conferences or whatever are still some of my best friends in the world. And it's a great, welcoming, student-friendly community, without a doubt.
And speaking of students, before we get into some of the amazing work that you've done with the rescue program, you do have an internship. So do you want to spend a moment highlighting that and letting our listeners know what you're looking for in your interns?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very, very proud of our internship program. It really actually is an extension of what we created at the Marine Mammal Center with Francis Gullin way a long time ago. So when I came to Vancouver within a few years, I wanted a program here that was similar, and it's taken off. Definitely one of the most competitive programs to get into. We are very, very lucky to get some of the best folks out in the field applying and joining us for a year. And I'm also very happy and proud to say that the vast majority of those folks have gone on and stayed in the field and are colleagues. Two of them are sitting board exams this past weekend. We've got folks at the Navy, at Shedd Aquarium, at Mystic Aquarium. We've had them at working for the government in fish aquaculture. And, you know, we judge our program by its success. And if I call our success the success of our folks that have come through here, then we've had a very successful program. Now, having said that, it is very competitive. What we're looking for are people that are going to go on and be in the field, much like our past fellows. And the things I look for to make me think that people will be successful after their year here are commitment to writing boards, being specialized, commitment to research and sharing and teaching and moving on in the profession and contributing to the profession. Certainly clinical aptitude is very, very important. We never take anyone fresh out of school. We're always looking for someone who's got at least a year of practical experience and preferably a rotating internship, a competitive one. And then we're looking at letters, folks that I can call and talk to that I get an honest opinion about. It certainly does help if you're in the IEEM crowd and have come up and said hi or come and visited us. Certainly being one of our extern students helps as well. A big issue for me is I've got a very amazing team that I work with at the aquarium. And we've been together, some of us, for 17 years. And so fit into our team is extremely important. And we're not like a lot of other teams. And we're definitely a little bit loosey-goosey, very relaxed, not a very formal program. Does that sort of make sense on who we're looking for?
Absolutely. Yes. I think anyone who's interested in the program or current veterinary students thinking about their future, I think that's a really great overview and good things that they can consider as they're trying to put together their application. So thank you for that.
Of course.
So let's talk about something that I know you're very passionate about, which is your sea lion disentanglement program.
Yeah, it is a really successful program, one of the first programs of its kind. It was not an easy program to start, and it was certainly not something we did in a vacuum by ourselves here in Vancouver. A lot of the work started when I was still at the Marine Mammal Center, actually a whole lot of work on the basis of how to safely anesthetize sea lions, how to fit enough meds into a dart, what kind of anesthetic combination. A lot of that early stuff was worked out at the Marine Mammal Center, and also in collaboration with Bill Van Bohn after I had left the Marine Mammal Center and continued on here. So really started in 1998 when we were approached by folks that were working with feller sea lion populations in Alaska that were particularly concerned about the Western population that was quite endangered and continues to be quite endangered. And those folks really needed to put transmitters on those animals, figure out where they went, what kind of resources they needed, take samples, take biometrics, figure out what was going on with them, how do they compare to the southern or southeastern population and why that population in decline. But at the time, the darting method that they used was producing about a 10% mortality rate, which was considered to be unacceptable. And so permits were pulled. So that was, I think, 1998 that we were approached at the Marine Mammal Center to see about coming up with a better protocol. And it was not until, I think, about 2013, after a whole lot of field work and trials and a lot of work on stranded animals, and then a lot of work in particular on one adult male stellar sea lion that we had here in Vancouver that had oral squamous carcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma. And that animal needed a bunch of chemotherapy and laser surgical procedures and a lot of anesthetic procedures over a long course of time. So that was the animal where we finally kind of came up with a safe protocol that was based on Lucy Spellman's drug dosages that she had tried on sea lions at the National Zoo a long time ago. So anyway, long story short, we've been quite successful at remotely mobilizing sea lions for research purposes through Alaska now. And then, of course, the thing that really tugged at my heartstrings, which was the issue of entangled animals and not being able to do anything about them until about 10 years ago when we initiated our program here in Vancouver. And it has been very successful. We've successfully immobilized and disentangled about 65 animals here in BC and shared that work with folks in Washington that were using the same protocol. Of course, folks in Marine Mammal Center in California are using the same protocol and gone on to use that in Mexico. Alaska, of course, is using it. And folks in South Africa have been talking to us about it, in Australia as well. So it's moving around and spreading in general quite successful. So yeah, super, super exciting to have a small role in helping to develop that program.
And so when you're talking about a protocol, is that a specific drug protocol?
Yeah, it starts with a drug protocol. So we're using a combination of metatomidine or dexmedetomidine, butorphanol, and midazolam. And then we reverse after we're done with atipamezole and naltrexone. Then the type of dart, big deal for us, was compounding. Way back when we were trying these combinations at the Marine Mammal Center, we were having to use three or four darts to fit everything in, obviously in a controlled setting. So compounding has helped manage that drug volume and allowed us to bring it out into the field into a single dart. So it starts with that, but it certainly doesn't finish with that. And we keep developing our protocol for every animal. Every animal is very unique. Every situation is very unique. So for a long time, we thought that we couldn't take really good accurate shots from the water, that we had to get onto land and spend a lot of time tracking animals. But since then, we've become a lot more comfortable in the water. The big issue, of course, has been in the beginning, the idea was that you needed to immobilize an animal very, very quickly so it wouldn't go in the water. And if an animal went into the water, that was a lost animal. You'd fall asleep, sink, drown. But that's actually not the case with this drug combination. And for the most part, the animals tend to float and sleep at the surface, which allows us to work animals that have gone into the water. And overall, I want to say, you know, maybe 2/3 of the animals we dart end up in the water. And so part of that is using two boats and manipulating two boats and proper search technique to look for those animals, because you're looking at a minimum of 12 minutes for the drug combination to take effect, which could be a long period of time when you're trying to look for an animal. So search patterns and coordination and coming up to an animal alongside and working with boat crews, taking shots from boats. So working with boat drivers that know how to approach an animal very carefully and then back off very carefully so we don't spook it too much. But we keep changing things and getting better and better. Like most recently, we used drones for the last few years to help us search for animals. So we have drones that follow right from the approach and the stock, watch that, and then just follow the animal if it happens to go in the water. So that's been awesome. Nowadays, we don't go out in the field without a drone operator, which has been kind of cool. But yeah, things change all the time, and I'm sure they will keep changing in the future.
That's amazing. What an amazing application of using a drone. Now, is that an instance where you know where the animal is located, or is it a situation where you've got a report that there's a local person that has found an entangled animal and then you're trying to find it? Because I've done a lot of work with cetaceans down in Florida, and I know that once we got a call, sometimes it could take days to find an animal if it starts swimming around. So how do you manage that aspect?
Yeah, that is an important issue. So we do get a lot of reports of animals, and we cover the entire British Columbia coastline. And some of that can be quite remote and difficult to get to. It might take us a day or more even just to get to a place. And as you say, the animals are mobile and they will not necessarily stay on one haul out for days on end. So unfortunately, we've gotten into the situation now where when we get a report from a member of the public or from our government agencies or from Whale Watch folks, we'll keep asking for a couple of days to see how if we could track the whereabouts and be somewhat sure that an animal will be in the same place when we go out to get it, because it can't be a huge amount of resources, right? Like it takes at least 4 or 5 aquarium employees, at least 2 to 4 fisheries employees, boats, ferries, planes, what have you, to get out there. So it can be a very expensive and logistically challenging thing, not to mention the weather, which is our number one challenge. We can't dart in high wind or high waves or particularly stormy conditions. So everything has to cooperate. So what we've switched to in many instances is just going out to areas where we know there are a lot of sea lions at a certain time of year and just surveying the whole group. So we will look for animals from the boat as we survey a haul out, but we'll also launch the drone, which can see a lot of animals that are sitting behind other animals lying down. So drones have been amazing for the surveys and locating animals and picking good targets to go after. And then on the other side of things, they've been valuable for tracking animals after we've darted them.
Amazing. These are the remote disentanglements, or when you're going out into the field to disentangle animals. But I know the Marine Mammal Rescue Facility does a lot of rescue, rehab, and release as well, correct?
Yeah, we see up to about 150 to 200 live stranded animals brought into our facility every year. So we're about fourth largest marine mammal rescue facility in the world nowadays. The vast majority are harbor seals. So that's kind of our number one patient, neonatal harbor seals. But we do see anything from harbor seals of all sorts of age classes, stellar sea lions, California sea lions, northern fur seals, Guadalupe fur seals, elephant seals, sea otters, had a variety of cetaceans brought in, and sea turtles we bring in. One every 2 or 3 years, we get a sea turtle way up here.
Wow, quite a diverse aspect of species. It's amazing. I see all the Facebook posts all the time when you have a successful release back, fourth in the world. That's incredible. Good job for you and your entire team for that great accomplishment.
It's a great facility. It's been kind of exciting because we've just switched it over the last few months back into being its own nonprofit organization. It's kind of under the aquarium umbrella still, but it's its own nonprofit now. So we can have a bit more flexibility and freedom in raising funds. And of course, there's always a shameless plug. Please donate and follow us and the rest of it. Yeah, it's a really, really great program. Super opportunity for our students, obviously. Great research opportunity. And of course, it's just primary mission is animal welfare, and it does a great job at that.
And that's the Marine Mammal Rescue Society, correct?
Yes, the Vancouver Aquarium Marine Mammal Rescue Society.
MMRS, amazing. Well, if anyone listening wants to donate or potentially volunteer to help you.
Yeah, we've got about 250 active volunteers, yeah.
Amazing. Well, it's an amazing program to join and be a part of. I know through this organization, you had recently helped work on both a killer whale and a gray whale field project.
Yeah, sure. A lot of what we do now is collaborate with other folks, especially when we're dealing with the cetaceans. Here in BC, of course, the killer whale is an iconic animal, and particular interest to a lot of folks are a subpopulation of killer whale called the southern residents, of which there are somewhere in the low 70s, and fortunately the number doesn't seem to be going higher, and in fact keeps dropping every now and then. So highly endangered group of animals, and a number of different threats have been identified to them. When there is a problem, when an individual animal has been identified as having a problem, we're part of the team that been asked to go out and assess and try and intervene. Now, it's a logistical issue. It's also a political issue. As a clinical veterinarian, when you tell me that I'm supposed to find out what's going on with an animal and treat it, but I'm not allowed to touch the animal, and I can't disturb other animals that it's with, and I can't place it in a controlled environment or do any sort of imaging or diagnostic test to speak of, and then come up with a treatment plan, which will also not cause any harm, might be successful, you don't know, and won't hurt any of the other whales in the area. So that becomes very interesting. The particular instance was an animal called J50, who was a juvenile killer whale, just a few years old, who'd identified as an animal in trouble even from birth. I think she was identified as having a very difficult birth, and it's always a little bit smaller than some of the other whales. But then a few years ago, it was identified that she'd been losing weight quite precipitously, and a technique called photogrammetry, which uses a drone at a very specific angle and height that photographs whales from above specific sort of ways, and then takes a number of very careful measurements and comes up with sort of an index of body condition. And the folks that have done that have been doing some really great work on killer whales here and in the Antarctic and all over the place, looking at body condition and how conditions change with environmental changes and stuff. So it's John Durbin and Holly Fernbach are the primary researchers we work with. So they identify this whale as being in a body condition that, if it was found in other killer whales in the southern resident group, none of those animals had survived. So it was quite obvious that this animal was not going to survive unless something was done. So Joe Gatos and a bunch of other folks from SeaWorld and from the San Diego Zoological Society, Jim McBain was called in for consultation as well to kind of come up with, what are we going to do? Well, there wasn't a whole lot that we could figure out about this whale other than it was very skinny. What are the things that can affect young killer whales in the wilds and under human care, you know, those pneumonias and parasite. And of course, the folks in SeaWorld were very, very aware and very good at documenting what kind of antibiotics had been used, what dosages are, what kinds of bacteria are primary causes of issue. So we essentially came up with a plan that included darting this animal with antibiotics and also with a dewormer, not thinking that these might be the primary issues affecting the animal, but thinking that they would be at least secondary problems, or they might at least alleviate some problems that would give the animal some opportunity to recover. So yeah, I think for the first time ever, we were allowed to intervene on behalf of a free-ranging endangered southern resident killer whale and try and come up with some kind of treatment plan. Joe and I darted the animal a few times, but it was not successful. And unfortunately, one of the things that happens is we don't get an opportunity to figure out what happened to the whale because they sort of disappear out at sea and we can't recover carcasses. And that brings up whole other issues. So unfortunately, we don't know what happened to J50 other than she had passed away. But from that whole experience, some really positive steps happened. Like we figured out we could deliver things to a whale. We could take drones and sample breath samples. We could find fecal samples. We could do some things remotely, and we could get together a team that could figure out what best to do given the guidelines at the time. So it was a big step forward for sure. It did give folks a little bit more ammunition for what to do next time. And the next time was a gray whale named Chocolate that just a couple of years ago, who had a satellite link transmitter implanted. Now I'm Canadian, so I have to stress it was implanted by the American side and became quite infected and really caused a lot of concern from the Whale Watch folks and from researchers and then the health experts. We've had some unusual mortality events in gray whales, so did not want to have another one go down as a result of human interaction, in this case for research purposes. So the go-ahead was given on the Canadian side to deliver antibiotics to that whale, and we did so, and this time quite successfully. And I have to say, Chocolate's wound kind of healed up. The satellite transmitter was eventually expelled, and everything went well. So there's progress. It's slow, and like I say, just being part of that team that's trying to come up with solutions for animals that are quite threatened or suffering or what have you, being part of that team is really quite special.
No, it's amazing, amazing stories. With respect to the gray whale, since we think that it was secondary to the satellite tracker that had been attached, are there thoughts for future satellite trackers being attached? For example, when we're doing annual health assessments with our bottlenose dolphins, or if we're doing them remotely on larger whales, that you'd add preventative antibiotics initially to potentially help prevent the spread of any type of infection?
No, I think in this particular instance, problems started quite a ways after the implant. So I think if you gave an antibiotics at the time of implanting, this transmitter probably wouldn't have had any effect at the time that the transmitter was causing problems. There certainly are various schools of thought on the types of transmitters that are attached to these whales. And this particular one does have some ethical and welfare concerns. Right now, the balance has shifted to information gained from these tags is so valuable that it outweighs the small percentage of animals that have had problems with it. But it doesn't mean that people haven't stopped working out how to make the tags better, how to make attachment better, and that sort of thing. So on the front end, that's where a lot of work is going and needs to go, rather than prophylactic antibiotics. I think the techniques, the technology, and the materials, that's probably where we get bigger bang for the buck right now.
Okay. And I agree. The information that we get from these satellite trackers is just so important, especially on those species and individuals that don't stay in one specific area, like the southern resident killer whales.
Correct. I have to say the southern resident whales have not been allowed to be tagged because problems that happened one time with a tag attachment. Up until very, very recently, we didn't know where the whales go. And in fact, we still don't know in detail where the animals go and what resources are really important to them. And we call them resident killer whales here in the Salish Sea, but they're not really that resident. They're here for a few months and then they're out in the open water on the outer coast. They go as far down as Monterey or even further south. They probably rely a lot on salmon that come out of Oregon and coastal Washington, as well as maybe even California. But we get really concerned about runs here in the Salish Sea. So that information would be super critical to know. But in the case of the killer whales, because there are so few of them, the scale is tipped the other way and saying that the risk of even one animal having a bad reaction to the satellite tag outweighs the benefit from satellite tagging and finding out more information. So it is a very interesting exercise each and every time for sure.
There's been a lot in the news lately about killer whales expanding their prey population and going to areas and getting different species that they wouldn't normally naturally eat. Do we think that this is mostly due to changing water temperatures, or do you have any thoughts in this area?
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts. One thing that's important to realize is we are better and better at gathering data. When we may have made assumptions 20 or 30 years ago on what prey animals were taking in, it may have been based on techniques such as actually looking at bones and hard parts and identifying things in feces or stomach washes, or opposed to now where we use a lot of DNA fingerprinting, we might use fatty acid signatures. Techniques are a lot more sensitive and probably a lot more reliable now. So it's sometimes hard to compare apples to oranges when we've used different techniques. So there might be some variation there. Now, at the same time, without a doubt, animals of all sorts, terrestrial and marine, are facing a difficult extinction event, right? We're losing more species now than we have maybe in any other era of the Earth. But some species are able to acclimate and change diets and do things and be a little bit more successful in a changing environment, whether that environment's changing because of natural causes or, well, let's face it, likely not, right? The issue is, of course, that our environment is probably changing at a faster rate than it normally does. I mean, there have always been environmental changes. That's the way the world goes, but the rate at which it changes is unnatural. So that presents crazy predicaments for these species. So it's a very complicated question, but when we're trying to assess risk factors for species and prey availability as a big risk factor, and maybe some species will switch, but then we don't know what the repercussions are of a species switch, right? We know that, for example, killer whales in the Western Aleutians started taking out sea otters. Now, whether they actually started actually eating them because they like that, or I mean, they're killer whales, they do stuff sometimes for fun, like we've got fish eating killer whales that kill harbor porpoise for fun, or whether they had to switch because that was an easy prey to get when other things were not there. But when they do that, you risk introduction of new parasites as intermediate, you risk introduction of new pathogens, you risk depleting that population so fast because sea otter population hasn't been designed to be predated on by killer whales. So now that you've got these ecosystem changes up and down as species change, you know, one species might be successful change, but that change might affect a whole other kaleidoscope of ecosystem. It gets very, very complicated, I think, very quickly.
Yeah, certainly does. And I know it's something that a lot of people are seeing in the media today, and there's a lot of differing opinions out there. So I think it's something we're just going to have to follow and make sure that we're reading a wide variety of sources and academic publications so that we're all educating ourselves on and why these animals are doing what they are.
Absolutely. I think the learning never stops. That's an important thing.
Well, Dr. Helena, thank you so much for being here today on Aquadocs and sharing all of your thoughts and wisdom with our listeners.
No, of course. Thank you very much. That was really cool.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Marty Helena for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA, AAFE, and the Cornell Wildlife Health Center, and all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield-Feig, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.